From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
People can naturally act, but no one can just naturally serve. You can give someone some dialogue and say, here's a moment, play this, and they can play it. But you can't give someone a surfboard and say, hey, go and surf.
In the new movie Breath, director Simon Baker didn't care that his two young leads had never acted as long as they could ride the waves. Baker is a surfer and actor himself. He spent years as a star of the CBS series The Mentalist. He talks about taking a big leap with Breath, shot in a remote corner of his native Australia with lots of filming on wild waves in unpredictable weather. He also explains his approach to a delicate aspect of the film, an older woman's very sexual relationship with a much younger boy. But first, a big week in banter. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague at Banter, Matt Bellamy of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So it finally came to pass that the court ruled a week ago or so that AT&T can go ahead and buy Time Warner. The judge was extremely definitive, didn't really give the Justice Department much of a leg to stand on if they wanted to try and shut it down. As we speak, they have not made an attempt to shut it down. The judge almost told them, don't try to appeal this ruling. You know, that's going to cause the lingering suspicion that this was political and had to do with Trump's dislike of CNN. And I don't know if that's true or not. We'll never probably totally know. But it does, it's just striking because now we see already we saw Disney bidding for Fox. We know there's going to be a round of big deals that people are making. We've seen Comcast jump in right away the minute that Time Warner AT&T deal was cleared by the court, saying we are going to do a better offer for the Fox assets that are for sale, the studio, the cable networks. We are seeing that battle. As we are talking now, that battle is very heated and could get even more heated. And those deals are a lot more what they call horizontal deals. AT&T isn't a different business from Time Warner. Time Warner's a content company. It's HBO, it's Warner Brothers, it's Turner, it's CNN. It's not a bunch of guys with eye shades who are tabulating statistics so much. So, but with this like Disney or Fox deal or potentially a Comcast Fox deal, they are more or less in the same business. There's much more overlap, at least for parts of their business. You know, they both have studios, they both have a network. So those are more horizontal deals. And having blown it with attacking a vertical deal, it seems sort of funny that now the Justice Department and the Antitrust Division are probably going to have to sit on their hands with much more horizontal deals.
Right. And the end result will likely be that there is one fewer buyer in a competitive market. But I think we can move past AT&T Time Warner. That is a done deal. They may appeal, but I doubt it. You know, now the focus there is on how you merge these two companies that are very different and have very different cultures. You know, everything from the fact that the HBO and Warner Brothers executives all fly business class and the AT&T executives do not, so there are likely changes coming there, to the fact that you have a very traditional telecom company and a high-flying Hollywood-oriented content company, and how do you merge those cultures? That is something that John Stankey, the new head of the AT&T content group, is going to have to deal with. And he's doing open houses and town halls at these companies to essentially try to figure out how to make this work. But the more interesting question is, what's going to happen to the Fox assets? This really is a war between Disney and Comcast. Brian Roberts at Comcast, Bob Iger at Disney do not like each other. They have been longtime rivals. They are now fighting over these highly desirable assets. And one analyst thinks that this bidding war could go up to $80 billion for these assets.
Yeah, you know, and I sort of have to watch and think, say to myself, how is all of this going to work? Going back to AT&T Time Warner, two hugely different cultures, huge problems of weight, expensive problems. Of course, people will lose their jobs, and that's going to be a problem for a lot of people in Hollywood and in the industry. But there are problems of melding these cultures, and sometimes these things go horribly awry. I mean, who can forget when AOL and Time Warner merged before? It was a debacle of epic proportions. And we're in a time where technology is changing all the time, where streaming is now a thing, but it wasn't a couple of years ago anywhere near what what it is now. So I feel like there's just huge risk with these big behemoth companies trying to integrate really different cultures. So I guess what I'm saying is, when you win, are you really winning, or are you bringing about problems? I mean, they all think they can't survive if they don't get bigger. I guess what I'm saying is, can you survive if you do get bigger?
Well, that's the question. And I think that the feeling at these companies is they don't have a choice. The rise of digital outlets like Facebook, Amazon, Google, Netflix to a certain extent, they have completely changed the game and have grown to a scale that the entertainment companies are just not able to compete with. So they feel like they have to. But, you know, there is an example of a merger very similar to the AT&T Time Warner merger, the Comcast NBC Universal merger from 8 years ago, that actually most people think has gone pretty well. The content assets were merged into this company that had a very, very different culture. Comcast is ultra conservative, and NBC Universal has all the cable networks and the broadcast network and the Hollywood film studio. And most people believe that the net result of that has been additive to all the businesses there. Can it be replicated with AT&T and Time Warner? Don't know. But at this point, if you are in the executive suite of one of these companies, you have to try.
Yeah, and what you have to, I think, understand is this is a creative business. And I don't think we just see this with the traditional, you know, with the cable company or AT&T buying Time Warner or the NBC Universal assets as they did. I think even the Silicon Valley originated companies, the digital companies, have come in. This is a specific culture in Hollywood, and you do have to loosen the reins to let creative people be creative. If you lean too hard on that, you're going to have problems. I think Netflix has found that talent needs to be treated a certain way. It's small things like calling a showrunner or a star after their show premieres if it seems to have done well and gotten good reviews. Just the niceties of doing business have to be observed. And the larger issues of creative freedom, I mean, you see a company like Comcast, super conservative, and their studio is releasing the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy, which a lot of people might have thought, well, how are they going to stomach that? Well, they stomached it and they made a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, and a perfect example is, how would Time Warner have handled the Samantha Bee controversy, where she called Ivanka Trump the C word and was not suspended or fired or anything? Would AT&T, if they were in control of TBS, where her show airs, would they have handled it the same way? I don't know.
I don't know, but I would say they should exercise great caution in trampling on things that are considered essential freedoms in the creative community. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
The new movie Breath tells the story of two teenage boys coming of age in a remote corner of Southwest Australia during the 1970s. Based on a novel of the same name by Tim Winton, Breath follows the boys, Pikelet and Looney, discovering a new passion, surfing. Pikelet, played by Samson Coulter, is more cautious than his aptly named friend Looney, played by Ben Spence.
Oh. I'll surf that one day. You dare me? I dare you to dare me.
Early in the film, the boys encounter Sando, a bohemian one-time surfing legend who becomes a kind of guru to them.
How does it feel when it's that serious?
You boys will find out.
You'll be out there thinking, am I solid or am I just ordinary?
Sando is played by Simon Baker, who also directed and co-wrote the film. With this film, Baker makes his debut as a feature film director. If you ever watched the CBS series The Guardian or The Mentalist, you're familiar with Baker's work as a television actor. In The Mentalist, he played former con man Patrick Jane, advisor to the California Bureau of Investigation. Jane would claim to be psychic while using keen observational skills to solve crimes.
Hello, we're from the CBI. May well be that one of you is the murderer. If that's so, I'm going to find out who.
You may have noticed in recent years that many leading men on American TV shows were not actually made in the USA. But when Baker started auditioning for TV in this country, he tried to downplay that fact.
Back in the sort of late 90s, there wasn't as many Australians here as there are now. And often I would come to an audition and not want to chit-chat, just do the scene, because as soon as you let them hear your Australian accent, All they can think about is like, oh, that's bizarre. You just changed your accent. Like, that was crazy. You know, and you're like, I don't want them thinking about that.
Right.
So I would walk in there, can we just do the scene straight away and then we'll have a little chat?
Yes. Well, you know, we did a piece once on NPR about doing the accent, and we wanted to use Hugh Laurie, and he said he couldn't do it because he only would do American accent. Even on the set, everywhere, he stayed in the American accent. So we got Damian Lewis, and he switched in and out for us, and Damian Lewis switched, and you just switched.
Yeah, I love being on set, but I got to be me when I'm on set. I've never been an actor that really sits in the trailer and reads a book. I'm pretty much always fiddling with bits and pieces of equipment, getting on the dolly, fiddling around with cameras. I love that stuff. So on a TV show particularly, there's always a lot of discussion about, very quick discussion, that is, how we're going to fix the script, how we're going to do this, how we're going to shoot it. While I'm articulating that stuff and involved in those conversations, I don't want to be thinking about my accent. So yeah, from very early on, I would drop it or pick it up. But I grew up with a lot of American television. Happy Days and Bewitched and Gilligan's Island and, you know, the whole deal. So you grew up listening to Americans on TV all the time. So it wasn't so bad for me.
You just alluded to this, but I read that you, while doing The Mentalist, almost deliberately started training to direct, that you were looking at how it's done. And of course, TV moves at the sound of light compared to a movie.
Yeah, that's why it's good practice.
But you did say to yourself, I'm going to get to do
this. Well, I directed first on The Guardian. I knew way back that I wanted to direct. And it's sort of a cliche, really, when you hear actors say, yeah, yeah.
When I grow up, I'm going to do.
I always felt like when I grow up, I will direct because that's really what I'm interested in. And when I signed on to do TV, I mean, TV came about for me in a way because at that time, my daughter was in school. Before she was in school, we were gypsies. So wherever I was shooting a film, I could go and do little independent films in Omaha, Nebraska, and we'd all just come along. But then once she got into school a little bit, she had her own little circle of friends. It's heartbreaking to pull her out of that. So it got to a point where I've got to do something that stays here. And there weren't many films at the time shooting in LA. Everything seemed to be in Canada or somewhere in the Midwest, wherever the tax breaks are, and they sort of shift
right now periodically.
Atlanta. Exactly. And I said, okay, I'm going to do a TV show. It's just got to shoot in Los Angeles. That was it. So that was really how TV came about for me. And I had enormous success. And after The Guardian, because that nearly killed me.
Why did it nearly kill you?
I was in every scene. Sometimes we'd shoot 18 hours a day and never a day off, and being ground down, and I had another young child that wasn't sleeping through the night, and it was a tough haul. And then after that, I thought, I'm never going to do it again. I'm not interested. And then a few years later, The Mentalist came around, and I had a very good friend of mine who's my agent in Australia, was dying of cancer. And I was in Australia when they offered it to me, and I remember chatting with him in hospital, and he said to me, he calls me Bakes. He goes, Bakes, you're a working man. He goes, you're happiest when you're working. Go and work. You know, and I was like, sort of, I get it. I'm, you know, because I'm very blue collar. I come from, you know, my stepfather was a butcher. So I get that. I have a work ethic, and I do like to get into the trenches. And I thought, look, I'm going to do this TV show. And if it goes, because you never know, it's always a roll of the dice, I'm going to use it to hone my skills and use it like a film school.
So the genesis of this is it that Mark reads the novel? I'm trying to remember what I've read about it.
Yeah, Mark read the novel, sent it to me.
This is Mark Johnson, the producer. And you knew Mark from The Guardian.
I knew Mark from The Guardian. I think I was probably the only Australian actor he knew that surfed. So that's maybe why he sent it to me. And I got back to him straight away and said, no, I'd love to be involved. That was to be a producer and to play the character that I played in the film, Sando. And then we started the process of development, and then we also started the process of looking at directors. And we looked at a bunch of different Australian directors. And then at a certain point, Mark, after, you know, maybe our sort of eighth meeting with the director, he said to me, you know, Simon, has it occurred to you that you should direct this film? And I said, why do you ask? And he said, because you sound like the director in these meetings.
That was Mark having an idea.
Yeah. You know, I knew all of those characters. I still know those characters in my life and in that world. And I think Mark cottoned onto that.
So you've got this novel. Mark mm-hmm. wants to produce mm-hmm. it. You mm-hmm. want to direct it. Mm-hmm. It's clear from the get-go that you were going to be that character of mm-hmm. the surfer guy.
Well, at the beginning, but you know, we had it for about 8 or 9 years. So towards the end, I was like,
oh, it was that long gestation.
Maybe I'm getting a bit old for this character.
So it was 8 or 9 years. It's much mm-hmm. longer. I had no idea it was that kind of time frame.
Well, it was difficult because I was working on the TV show. And, you know, I had a 2-3 month hiatus. And there was no way with a film like this, the casting alone took a year.
Well, let's talk about that for a sec. You're sure. looking for boys who can surf.
I'm looking for surfers that had some sort of charisma. People can naturally act.
Right.
Right. But no one can just naturally surf. You can give someone some dialogue and say, here's a moment, play this, and they can play it. But you can't give someone a surfboard and say, hey, go and surf.
And I had read that the surfing was mostly done by the actors in the film. And there's some very scary shots. They had to not just be surfers, but capable surfers.
They had to be really competent, yeah. And the other thing was that, you know, growing up surfing myself, when you play any sport from a young age, there's a physical confidence that you carry. It filters through everything that you do, that physical confidence. And I'm making a story about kids in the 70s. Kids were more physical in the 70s because they weren't sitting behind screens all the time. They were out and about and they were expanding their horizons and looking for adventure.
Yeah, I think about when I was a kid, you just, you know, you were running through the neighborhood doing whatever, and they, my parents were both at work. They didn't have the faintest idea.
Yeah. You get to understand yourself and you get to know your own limitations and you get to trust that you can handle certain situations. So I wanted to find kids that had that in them. And, you know, an interesting part is the girl that plays Queenie Cookson.
Which is the young girl, who sort of aspiring girlfriend of your lead character. Yeah.
Here's a girl that had never acted before. She was the first person cast in the film. She caught a bus from Brisbane to a little town in Bangalore where I was going out regionally meeting people. And that's a 3-hour bus ride. 17 years old, 16 years old at the time, caught a bus on her own, came down to audition and made it to this little town and then went back. And she was fantastic. But that kind of single-mindedness and that kind of confidence in herself, it spoke to me in a way that, like, kids like this don't exist as much anymore.
How many boys did you have to try?
I think it was close to the thousands.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. They sent in, you know, this is where social media worked with casting, like a really wide net. We sent out one scene. They could choose either character and just send an iPhone.
A scene between the two boys, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and we got an enormous amount of responses and we went out through schools and surf clubs, and it went like wildfire through Facebook and social media, and we had an incredible number of responses, and that was hard to whittle it down and then go to these locations, regional sort of points, to have a day or two of casting and just seeing, because, you know, all of these kids are pretty raw, very raw. None of them pretty much had acted.
So did you get to a point of thinking, I'm not going to find them, or did you feel like you had options?
You know, always throughout this process, you have to just believe in the process itself. So yes, you're not always going to have solutions to everything immediately. It did take a year, and we whittled it down to 6 boys for those 2 roles, brought them all to Sydney for a 3-day workshop, which was fantastic. And then out of that, 2 rose up.
Coming up after a short break, first-time feature director Simon Baker tells us about shooting on the water in extreme weather. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Simon Baker, director, co-writer, and one of the stars of the new movie, Breath. The film tells the story of Pikelet and Looney, two best friends in a small town in Australia, who fall in love with surfing. Over time, the boys find that they have different approaches to the ocean and to life. That starts to become clear on a day of intense weather promising massive waves. Pikelet, played by Samson Coulter, decides to bow out. The boys' surfing mentor, Sando, played by Simon Baker, urges Pikelet to change his mind, while Looney, played by Ben Spence, is not so supportive.
I don't know if I'm feeling it.
Come on, Pikelet, you know what's what.
You're a coward.
Show a bit of support.
What for? He's chicken.
Seeing the towering waves in the movie, it's easy to understand why Pikelet hung back. And filming those surfing scenes was not easy either. Shooting on the water. Mm-hmm. It's like a death wish in a certain way, right? I remember back when Jim Cameron was doing Titanic, everybody's like, it's on the water. It's a period piece. Shooting on the water is...
He might have had a little bit bigger budget than
He had a slightly bigger budget,
And not 36 days to shoot it in.
Right. And you had tremendous weather going on. And I don't know whether all the weather was written into the script or you just went with the weather you got.
No, there was a lot of weather written into the script because I knew the place. I first found it and I went back three times on my own. I live in Sydney. It's on the other side of the country.
What distance is that?
It's a 4.5 hour flight and then one flight per day for another hour or a 5.5 hour car drive.
So way the heck out there.
So yeah, it's a day traveling to get there. But you know, this was a dream for me. So I spent as much time as I could out there. And
did you surf?
I surfed, but I photographed every square inch of the place. I did a water recce with our water crew on jet skis, basically going combing the coastline.
A water recce.
Water recce, yeah. Oh, reconnoiter.
Reconnoiter, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's my Australian accent playing with you, sorry. So, yeah, I knew the place pretty well. And, you know, James Cameron's, that's an interesting one because our films couldn't be further apart. And our approaches to making the film couldn't be further apart. I mean, from what I gather, James arm wrestled the water to the ground.
I think he believes he can do that. I'm not sure he could.
I mean, maybe he does believe that. I think if you've got a lot of manpower and many, many resources, you can keep throwing stuff at it. But everyone really knows, like just through the devastation of what the water can do when it's moving. I've grown up on the water. So my approach to it was a far more sympathetic approach to it. Instead of trying to manhandle it, just understand that, you know, Mother Nature is the star of the film and she'll come out of a trailer when she wants to and she'll go back into a trailer when she wants to. And sometimes they're the circumstances that you have to live with. You just got to sit, bide your time, shoot something else, be flexible and be humble. So we were a very nimble little crew. I had a water cinematographer and I had a separate little team and they were only available to us for 4 weeks of our 6 week shoot. So yes, it was praying for the right conditions, but also being able to move quickly and efficiently. So you use all the technical advantages that are up your sleeve. We had the luxury of shooting on the Red Dragon in the water, so you can shoot at a higher resolution and then you can... Red Dragon is a camera.
Okay.
If you're shooting at a higher resolution, you can blow up and reframe within the frame that you get from the daily. So you're sort of, you're getting your dailies and then you're remaking your dailies in post-production as well, very simply.
My extensive knowledge of surfing, which is based entirely on having seen your film, is that these big waves don't come on command either.
No, you're waiting for the right swell from the right direction and hopefully the wind cooperates as well because the weather can change. And it did. There was a couple of times when there was, and it's in the film, there's dark gray skies and they're big fronts coming in and you can see them. When you're on the water, it's powerful because you see it come in.
I think it was just powerful enough in the theater for me. Thank you.
Within 5 minutes, there's horizontal rain that you can't even open your eyes because stings so much, it hits you.
You go out there with these kids or you use a stunt double?
No, we're all out there.
A little bit of stunt double.
There's doubles, but we're all out there. I mean, there's doubles because there's no resetting and let's go for another take. It's just like, let's all rotate and we'll see what we can get. If there's three characters in the water, if we've got six surfers covering those characters, we've got twice as much chance of getting the shots we need.
So you use the best thing.
Yeah.
So going to the subject matter, you know, this is a coming of age and finding out who you are and when you can draw a boundary basically or not. But there is a, I'm trying to frame it so I don't give away the plot of the movie, but there is a relationship between the boy who is 13.
Well, he starts off as 13 and
a
half.
Woman and who's an adult.
But I don't ever articulate super clearly how old he is at that point, but time has passed and the kid is obviously grown.
He's grown, but you know,
he's probably 16 at that point.
Was there any thought, like, 16? You know, because if you reverse genders, people would be like, horrified. Was that a thing that you guys talked about? I mean, it came up in Call Me By Your Name. Like, is it comfortable that this boy in Call Me By Your Name is sleeping with an adult man?
I don't think it's meant to be comfortable, is it?
No.
I mean, that's the nature of art. I mean, this is what's interesting to me is that what we do socially and what we agree that is the correct way to approach things culturally and socially, they shouldn't necessarily always inflict what we do with art. Because that becomes a form of censorship. It was a big part of the book and it was a sort of a profound part of the book. There, here is this kid that is finding himself and he has this sort of sexual awakening. And then, you know, the movie is really a lot about those lines that you cross sort of unknowingly in your life until in hindsight you can look back and see those moments. They stick out glaringly.
Where you're in too deep.
Where you're in too deep, where things become real. You know, what is that moment that transitions you from a child to an adult? What is the moment going to be that I step outside of my midlife crisis? I don't know. I will know probably when I'm 75 if I get that far. But when you're in it, you're not aware of it. So I was comfortable with trying to capture how uncomfortable that moment was. Who knows how things happen in life? Things can escalate. And I like that unpredictable nature. And I talked about this with the author, Tim Winton. We toured the film in Australia. He said something that was pretty amazing. He said that that's life, that's art. Like people don't, you know, finish their bowel movement when they have a heart attack. Things shift, things get derailed.
It's an image.
I'm trying to make it visual for you.
Thank you.
You know, they don't get to call all of their kids before they pass away and say goodbye. Life gets interrupted all the time, and I think that's unpredictable.
So in the book, I understand it's more explicit that this actually has an impact on the character going forward.
Yeah, it's far more explicit.
You know, because there's a sort of a trope of the young boy, the older woman.
Well, I did try to play with that before it got dark.
Yes.
Yeah, because I like the idea of like, oh, wow, this is fantastic. This is this sort of adolescent fantasy, and then it's like, whoa, it's not quite what you think it is.
Yeah.
Things get serious.
So you want the audience to just get the picture that it's not necessarily going to be, he just goes forward and he had this cool coming of age fantasy experience.
No, there's bumps and hurdles. And, you know, this is what's sort of fantastic about us as humans is that just when you think you kind of got everything worked out and you've got this, I'm on top of this, the rug gets pulled out from underneath you and you fall on your face. We have to be adaptable. You know, we evolve within each crisis, each moment. And I think the human instinct is to try to control it so that we can avoid those traumas and those things. But I don't think we ever will. It's about accepting that notion of evolution and having to adapt. And I think we're right in the middle of that. Right now. I mean, yeah.
Simon Baker is the director, a star, and co-writer of the new movie, Breath. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.